Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We are unable to speak as planned today with our guest, Texas House Representative Jim Dunham, but we are working to reschedule him and expect to welcome him to the show in the next week or two. Instead, for now, we bring you an archive edition of the show featuring composer Philip Glass. It originally aired April 17th. Where does music come from, and what beyond innate talent is required for an artist to create melodies that haunt or delight, enrage or inspire? Philip Glass has been writing and playing music since he was a child. He studied at the University of Chicago and then Juilliard and followed his passion to Europe and later India as he nurtured his obsession with repetitive musical structures that, as one writer describes, immerse the listener in a sort of sonic weather that twists, turns, surrounds, and develops. Although Glass has a rabid global following today, he was over 40 before he was able to finally quit his job as a cab driver once and for all and focus solely on music. Glass has written symphonies, operas, concertos, and scores for films as diverse as The Hours, The Illusionist, and the Koyaanisqatsi films. One of his most recent works, he created the score for the Woody Allen film Cassandra's Dream. That was a composition from Philip Glass's score from the movie Cassandra's Dream. Philip, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Happy to be here, Chris.
So you get up every morning and write music?
Well, today I got up this morning and went to a radio station, television station. but when I can, I do. Yes, that's right.
It's interesting because that sounds remarkably like the way a lot of writers will talk about their day.
Is that right?
Yeah. That if they don't get up and do it, sort of the discipline fades away. Is it that way for you, or are you
driven? I just need the time. I have the discipline, but at a certain point in your life, you begin to realize that you're not an immortal being and time is running out and there are things that you want to do. So I get up, I'm usually up around 6 and I try to get to work by 7.
Does the time go quickly for you when you're writing?
Too quick.
Mm-hmm. So you're in that sort of state of flow.
I never thought of it that way. But that's a good description.
Mm-hmm. And when you say time is running out, I wonder, do you have sort of a laundry list of things that you want to accomplish in your career?
It's not a specific list. It's just that I keep on thinking of things I want to do. I'm thinking ahead at least 3 years. Mm-hmm. When I'm working for example, operas usually take a 3-year period of planning. I have 2 that I'm working on, so that takes me up till 2010. And I'll be thinking about 2011. And then films come up and go very quickly, but they have to be fit in. A film happens in maybe 5 or 6 weeks. It's fairly quick. But then there are other things, as symphonies and so forth, that can take a couple months or 3 months. Then I'm performing a lot. I'm doing 50 concerts a year.
You are still performing all the time. And I wonder if it feels like an entirely different exercise for you.
It's a different role. And it took me years to really understand it, though I began as an instrumentalist. Of course, most composers have. I began playing the flute when I was 8, and I switched to piano when I was 15. I was writing when I was 15. I began working professionally doing piano concerts probably in my 30s, when I was 30. I had been playing until then, but at a certain point, I found that there was an interest in my playing, and I could play. So I began writing more music for piano and starting to do concerts like that. And then I became aware that I had become an interpreter of music, not a creator of music. And that's a very different role. At this point, I'm playing sometimes pieces that I wrote 20 or 30 years ago. And the relationship to a piece that that was born in time so long ago, that distance brings a perspective to the music that I would never have had at the time that I wrote it.
So do you not perform other people's music typically?
No, I don't. Basically, I don't have time to. And I've honed my pianistic skills almost entirely to what I do. So when I was younger, I would play Schubert and Mozart and Bach and so forth. But I don't think anybody would pay a dime to hear me play Mozart these days. It's really not worth it. What I really do is play my own music, and I've become a specialist of that.
Is it hard when you do play your own music to also find other musicians that you feel like fit the bill completely?
I've been very fortunate that way. I've had an ensemble which I put together in 1969, so that's close to 40 years. And we're just at the point now where some of my earliest players are beginning to retire, which is kind of a big shock to us because we were basically a group of seven. Typically, there have been three or four men and two or three women, keyboards and wind players. And we kind of were getting older together, and we just replaced one of our 60-year-old players because he was having hearing problems and he couldn't play with us anymore. And we replaced him with a young man in his 20s, and we realized that the average age of our ensemble had gone down to 50.
Just by adding one person.
By adding one person. And then I had a realization, which I never had the opportunity to think about, which is that now the ensemble is going to start getting younger instead of older, and that there will be younger players. And the difference, Chris, is that these young players grew up in a world in which my music already existed. Whereas the older players were with me when I was making it.
Before everyone thought it was a great thing.
Very few people thought it was a great thing. But we had always had an audience. I began doing concerts in Europe and America in the early 70s.
Composer Philip Glass is my guest. He's in town for an address tonight for the Nasher Salon Series. It's got to be heartbreaking to have a colleague and someone that you sort of grew up with who doesn't hear well anymore. Is that something that you worry about, that you fear?
For myself?
Yeah.
Not so much. The ensemble's more or less stuck with me. I'm not having those problems. I don't have. But when you play with someone for 35 years, it's more than a friendship. My playing with me was the career for that person. That's what he spent his life doing. And it was a very close relationship, and it has been with those people. So seeing them go, it's not a death in the family. That is not that severe, but it's a loss of a contributor and a musician who meant a lot to us. And that is the future. I'm looking now. I look at the place and say, well, I wonder how long this person can stay. But fortunately, the singers usually tend to be younger, and the sound people tend to be younger. But this is just. There are not that many composers that have had an ensemble for a lifetime. It's kind of like what Dave Brubeck did, or what a live jazz band would do. And Brubeck is in his 80s and still playing very well, by the way. So people like that are inspiring. Inspiring to me. I'm in my 70s, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, there's still people older than me still playing. Ravi Shankar, who I worked with for many years, is 88 now. And we still work together. I'm still writing music with him. He plays with his daughter, Anushka, but he doesn't play as fast as he used to, but he still plays very beautifully. So musicians have been blessed mainly, usually with longevity. I think that the playing of music is good for you. It gives you a longer, healthier life, it seems. My personal idea is that the parts of our being which have to do with moving and feeling and thinking are integrated in the making of music, so that we have the living integration of our diverse parts of our beings happening almost every day.
Let's hear a little bit in a minute from your concerto for harpsichord and orchestra, and I'm wondering if there's anything you want to tell us about it before we listen.
It was written for a group in Seattle. I'm thinking of that because I'm drinking some coffee that was made in Seattle, so that's a nice coincidence. And I was thinking about the instrument in its both in its incarnation as a feature musician in Baroque ensembles, and as it can be used in modern music as well. So I was thinking of it as somehow bridging those two worlds.
That was a little bit from Philip Glass's Concerto for Harpsichord and Orchestra. Can you hear the composition as it will sound when you're writing? Can you hear it in your head exactly the way it will be?
I can hear it in my head, but it's not the way it sounds. How can I explain it? I can visualize music, if I can use the word visualize in the sense of hearing instead of seeing. And I can do that fairly completely. That's the kind of training that I received from Nadia Boulanger and the other great teachers that I had. Her main effort was to teach me to visualize music, and I did accomplish that to a large degree. But the first time you hear a piece that you've written, it's an unbelievable kick. I can't tell you. I did a Symphony Number 8 a few years ago, and a very complicated, very dynamic piece. And then about 6 weeks later, I came to a dress rehearsal before the premiere. And hearing it was such a thrill. It's the difference between looking at the picture of a beautiful lake and a sunset and actually being on the lake and seeing the sun. That's a pretty good analogy.
It must be amazing, too, when you're in a space where the sound is going to be perfect and beautiful. Is there even something that when the orchestra is sort of tuning up that you get excited knowing that sound is coming?
There are certain halls that do that for me. Carnegie Hall, New York, you know, the one they say, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? You practice. That's the hall. And I play there about a couple times a year. And it, to me, is the reason I like that hall very much. By the way, the Metropolitan Opera also is a very beautiful house, so a very big house. The reason I like that hall is that what I'm hearing on the stage is what you're hearing in the hall. And that, to a musician, is the ultimate. That means that I know that what I'm hearing, the audience is hearing. There are halls that are not like that, where what you're hearing is not what is being heard in the hall, and you can only guess at it.
Composer Philip Glass is my guest. He's in town for an address and concert for the Nasher Salon Series tonight. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment, and you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is composer and performer Philip Glass. Philip, what is your relationship to silence?
Well, it's what I prefer when I'm not listening to music. But, for example, when I go to I go to restaurants that don't play music. I don't like having music as a background doesn't appeal to me. I was talking to someone who was looking at the things in my house, and I said, "Is that your stereo?" And he was looking at a kind of a cheesy little stereo, and I said, "Yeah." He said, "A musician like you, and that's what you have for stereo." I said, "Well, I don't listen to music I either play music or I'm thinking about music, but when I'm not, I like the stretches of silence."
And you have two little kids running around at home, is that right?
I do.
There can't be a lot of silence.
Well, they're on the fourth floor. I'm on the first floor when I'm playing. But they come down and play the piano for me, too. They're both playing. Mm-hmm. One is six and one is four.
That must be exciting. Is it hard not to attach too much emphasis to wanting them to be just brilliant?
They're so different. You know, the children have such a remarkably different personalities that I very quickly have find that we have different relationships. We talk about different things. We have different aspirations. I mean, they do. I find this. I have two older children too. One of them is a songwriter.
Your older children are adults.
Yeah. My songwriter son lives in Brazil, which is a good place for a songwriter. And my daughter is just moving to Washington. She writes for food magazines, which she loves doing. She's an expert on food, which is, I guess, a fun thing to do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to...
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Hi, Mr. Glass. Pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, Chris, for taking my call.
Sure.
Mr. Glass, Chris mentioned earlier that you were in India for some time, and yeah, I'm aware of your working with Mr. Shankar. Have you dabbled in any Hindustani-based music, or do you find that something that you have any interest in working with in that sense? Because the foundations for music in Asia, as we know it, is so much more different than the foundations of music here, the cycle patterns, the beat patterns, etc. And I'll take my answer off the air, if that's okay.
Thanks for your call.
I met Ravi Shankar when I was in my 20s, and he was in his 40s. He was in Paris to do a film score, and I was hired to be his assistant. I didn't know him before then, and in 1964, I knew very little about Indian music, as most people didn't know very much about Indian music. The Beatles hadn't gotten to India yet, and the big explosion of information that came with that, if you might remember, hadn't taken place yet. And in order to notate his music, because my job working for him was to write down his music so that a small ensemble of French musicians could perform it for this film, I had to come to terms with the structure of the music. And it was a very intensive and exciting time, probably less than a month that I spent with him at that time. But then I kept in touch with him. It happened he went to New York the next year, and I began studying tabla, which is the, for people who might not know, it's the two drums used in Hindustani music. Hindustani music means North Indian music. Carnatic music is South Indian music. And Raviji is from North India, so that's what I did. And his tabla player was a wonderful player named Alaraka, who you probably remember his name and know who he was. And I knew that I could see Raviji and I could talk with him, but the person who could really teach me would be Alaraka. So I took up the tabla, not to be a tabla player, because I was far too old to take up an instrument of that kind and ever hope to be proficient enough to be a concert musician on that instrument. But I wanted to understand the structure of Indian music, and I thought the key to that would be through the percussion, and turned out to be a very good guess and a very good help to me. That experience opened a big door for me, and once I really began to get a grip on the structure of the music, and I combined that. By that, you have to remember, by that time, I'm 27 or 28. I've been to Juilliard. I've got my degrees there. I've been with Nettie Boulanger. In fact, I've been playing at that point. I've been a musician for 20 years. But at that point, I would say the next 10 years integrating what I learned from Alaraka and Ravi Shankar into the language of my music. And that really led to things like Einstein on the Beach and Satyagraha and Kainaskasi and even actually all the music you've been hearing on the radio today. It's all been informed by that that encounter that I had with a great tradition of concert music, but not based on Central European our traditions.
Let's hear a little bit from Kainaskasi. That was a selection from the 1982 film, scored by Philip Glass, Kainaskasi. How important is it to you, Philip, that your scores work on their own without seeing the images that accompany them in the film?
That's always an afterthought. The films generate the ideas for the music. It's usually that way. And the score is written for the picture. At the end of that time, I usually hand it over to Michael Reisman, who's my music director and advisor for my ensemble, and I let him make the adaptation for the CD. I find it it's better if someone. No, Michael's been with me since 1973, so it's been a long association, and I trust him completely. And he makes the cuts for he makes the arrangement for the record. It's not always exactly the same as the film. For example, there could be certain bits of music that don't appear in the film, for the film is edited in a way and certain pieces fall out, or maybe there are versions of the themes that weren't as suitable for the film, which could work very well on the record. So the record is really the composer's distillation of what the film music is. It's only when we reach that point that I begin to think of it as a purely audio experience.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is composer Philip Glass. Let's speak next to Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just wanted to say I saw Kainaskasi at a drive-in theater in the middle of the night with about two other people at the theater, and it was absolutely one of the most exquisite experiences I've ever had in my life. The music made it, period. I just wanted to know if the music was composed for the film or the film adapted to the music.
That's an unusual situation, because in this case, I just said before that the film comes first. In this case, that wasn't the case. Godfrey Reggio, the filmmaker, was editing and assembling the images while I was writing. And, for example, he would give me what we call an assemblage. It would be a collection of images on a certain topic, on a subject. Let's say like airplanes. You remember that part of the where there are airplanes and the LAX airport in Los Angeles. You see them moving around, and they weren't in any particular order. And I began writing music for the idea, and the, let's say, the emotional context that airplanes exist in a certain way. Then Godfrey took my music and then began editing the images to the music. So we had a real kind of artistic dialogue. That is unusual. That doesn't happen that much. In that Godfrey's movie, A Kind of Scotsy, is not made by a studio. It's in what we call an independent movie. They're never marketed for big bucks or big distribution. Though over the almost 25 years of life that the film has had, it's been seen by many, many people. I mean, many more people than we ever thought would see it. So over a kind of a lifetime, it's had a big audience. But it's not made for that kind, for the kind of marketplace, that most studio movies are made for. That means that we have more time, by the way. We don't have a deadline. We don't have a release date. No one's really waiting around for Godfrey Reggio's next movie, or they might be for Errol Morris's movies, because Errol's movies have become more current now. But independent movies are done when they're done. They're not done when the studio says they're done, and that's a big difference.
That film feels so spiritual, and the music in it does as well, and there's the element of chant. And I'm wondering if for you, spirituality and music are inextricably linked, or if one is a substitute for the other at times.
Well, I think the first is the case, and I think almost any composer will say something like that, and they may say it in different words, but there's no question that we're working in a very eloquent language. The language of music is probably, in my view, it's the most eloquent human language that exists. So we share it with some animals, too. It's not just human beings who make music. But it speaks us directly to our emotional centers. And at the same time, it challenges our ability to think abstractly. So we bring two levels of thinking to music. There is no real music without the spiritual side to it. That's a good description. Bach thought of his music that way. Bruckner thought of his music that way. Beethoven did. Stravinsky did. Almost everybody does, actually. That's true for popular music, too. It's not just classical art music that's like that. Whether it's Paul Simon or David Byrne or Laurie Anderson, they'll be thinking about, or people who maybe play flamenco music, or people who play different kinds of ethnic music. I spend a lot of time working with musicians from around the world, whether they're from Australia or Africa. That's one of the great experiments I've done in my lifetime, and I find that the great commonality we have that crosses the barriers that might exist between the techniques and specific language of the music of our ethnicity, of our own background, the things that we have in common is the spiritual power of the music.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Philip Glass. Let's go next to Roger in Dallas. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Oh, this is a great show, Mr. Glass. It's a real honor. I saw you perform on one of your evenings of your solo piano tour that you did, I think, in late 93 or early 94, saw you in Austin, Texas, and I was close enough to the front that I could actually see your hands on the keyboard, and it was just a mesmerizing evening. It's unforgettable, so thanks for that. But I wanted to ask you if, you know, I understand you live in the Northeast, and it's a very fast-paced environment, but yet, like Chris was saying, your music seems to come from kind of a deep emotional and spiritual well. I'm wondering, is there anything that you do to kind of clear your head and get centered, like maybe meditation practice or anything like that, not just for composition, but also to keep yourself kind of calm and centered performing on stage?
Not only that, and I think you hit on several important areas, but I have to keep physically in good shape. Musicians are very much like athletes. We have to be physically able to play. And the kind of stamina to sit down and play from memory 90 or 100 minutes of music without printed music in front of you. That takes a kind of mental stamina too, and so I think of myself as always. I'm always in training. I do some of the things I do. I do a number of things. There's a qigong practice, which is a kind of it's like tai chi. It's like a Chinese martial arts form, but it's a little bit different. But it has the same root. So that's part of what I do. Another thing which may surprise you, it may not seem connected, but to me, very is connected, is I go climbing. My favorite places to climb happen to be in central Mexico because I just like the mountains there. So I go climbing there at least once a year. And
are you a risk taker?
Well, I don't think of it that way. However, the kinds of mountains I climb, you don't fall. You might roll down them, but you won't fall down a precipice. Sometimes when I'm there on the side of a mountain, I'm thinking, "What am I? I'm 7 years old. I'm sitting. What am I doing on this mountain?" You know. But I've been doing it. I'm comfortable doing it, and one of the things that I do when I'm climbing is I in order to survive that strenuous and the physical and mental demands of climbing, I have to pay attention to what I'm doing. And I can't think of any more difficult and demanding meditation than climbing. If you're sitting and meditating and fall asleep, well, you fall asleep. If you're climbing, you fall asleep. You fall off the mountain. It's a very big difference. There's a big reality check about that, and I think I like that.
Musician and composer Philip Glass is my guest. We'll return to our conversation in just a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800...
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is composer and performer Philip Glass. I want to listen next to a piece from In the Upper Room, Dance 9. Is there anything you want us to be thinking about before we listen? I love this one, by the way.
This was a Twyla Tharp's company, and quite a very beautiful company. I think he did it in 1987. And they dance with ballet shoes and with tennis shoes, both.
Was from In the Upper Room, Dance 9, composed by Philip Glass, who is my guest this hour. You know, listening to that, Philip, I almost think that watching dancers on a stage would be a distraction from the music.
You know, it's my first experiences in music were with dancers. I was at Juilliard, a young student writing music, and I said to myself, well, who actually wants music? And I discovered that dancers did. There was a dance company there. Martha Graham and Jose Limon taught at Juilliard at that time. And I immediately began, I began accompanying some classes, and I began writing music for the dancers. And I found out that theater people wanted music too. I meant people who was looking for new music. I wanted to be in a situation where people needed music and that I would provide it. So from my first experiences in concerts were with dancers. And it remains to be a strong connection to this day.
One thing that's interesting about that piece in particular is that you use the human voice more like an instrument than mm-hmm. than like a voice.
Yes, that's true. That particular singer has been with me for a while now, Lisa Bielava. She's also a composer, by the way. By the way, my core group of seven musicians, six of them are composers. We don't play their music on my concerts, but I have been helpful or try to be with their music, and I attend their concerts. So there's a kind of reciprocity that way. But when we're playing concerts, she is doing my music. Now, what I liked about her voice was the clarity of it, which you can hear, the precision of the pitch, which you can also hear. And when you look at music that way, the human voice is an unparalleled. It takes a very, very expensive computer to sound that good. And even then, it won't sound that good.
And more different one from the next than any two horns or any other instruments you could ever have.
Almost true. Violins can be quite different. String instruments can have that kind of individuality. But you're quite right. When I audition singers for operas, I'm listening to quality. I'm not listening to range. Or I'm listening to the kind of personality that is in the voice.
Let's listen. Let's speak next to Ada in Bedford. Hi, Ada.
Hello. My question, my comment is not meant to be either insulting or presumptuous, but I felt when I first started listening to Mr. Glass's music that it was highly intellectual. And over the years, I feel that I recognize a more emotional component. And I wondered if Mr. Glass could comment on that. Am I totally off the mark?
Well, I think that's a very good comment, and I think two things happened. I think you changed, and I think I changed. So I think, I don't know which of us changed most or when we did it, but when I look at the early pieces, they do, the early, early pieces from the 70s, and they seem more abstract to me. The pieces I do now seem more emotional to me. So I think that... It happened to fit your development, too, and I guess it's in a good way, if that's what you like. That certainly appeals to me. Now, when I go back to those early pieces like Music in Fists and Music in Slow Motion, I tend to inflect them and to project into them much more emotional content than I had when I originally played them. So I'm going back to the early pieces and putting my musical experience and my musical chops, as we say, at the service of music that was probably meant to be a little more abstract. The music I do now is, I think that piece we just heard, I think all the pieces we heard today actually have a strong emotional profile to them. But thank you for your comment.
When you talk about your musical chops, you also write etudes and we have one from 2003, which is etude number one. And I'm not a musician myself, but it sounds just like the most incredibly difficult thing to play there possibly could be.
I wrote the etudes, and I've written about 16 of them, to create musical hurdles for me to jump over. And each of the etudes has a different physical, demand on it. And by learning the etudes, my playing actually got better.
Thank you.
when you hear a piece like that, that was demanding to compose and then to play, do you strain against the impulse to move with it, to have your hands moving in the same way? Do you sort of feel the position you're in when you're sitting there performing the piece?
The wonderful thing about piano music is that it is it's built for the player. It's built for my hands. If you listen to the music of Rachmaninoff, he was famous for having very large hands and being a very fine player. And if you listen to the music, you can imagine what his hands must have been like. They were great instruments and great, and the power of his technique had to do with that. I'm a more limited player by far than that, but even so, I have my own limits and I try to test them. And there are physical limits to what we can do. One of the great things about music is that we embrace it in our physical bodies as players, whether we're singers or violinists or even conductors, and certainly pianists. The expression of music is impossible without the physical presence of the player. And I said earlier in our talk that it's the integration of our physical being with our emotional being and let's say our spiritual being. That's another good way to put it, our intellectual being. Maybe there are four. We can talk about it that way. When we are playing at our best, and even at our worst for that matter, when we're playing at all of those centers become activated. And it's the integration of that where we become as close as we can to being a complete human being. I think that's how musicians feel about it, that when we're playing, we feel we have completed some, we've linked up parts of our being and put them into alignment, and the result of that is the music that you hear.
Let's go next to Lionel in Dallas. Hi, Lionel.
Hi, Mr. Glass. It's an honor to speak. Hello?
Hi.
Yes, I'm here. Thank you.
Yes, it's a great honor to speak with you. I've enjoyed your music since I was in art school, and I had a question about art, the visual arts. I know you sat, or Mr. Close used a photograph for your wonderful portrait in that I saw in D.C. I'm not sure where it is now. But I also, upon reading a number of journals of artists like Kandinsky and Paul Klee, noted how they mentioned that sometimes when they painted, they actually heard a color. And I was wondering if you had any sort of relationship with the visual arts through your music. And if not, if you're simply appreciative, or if you have any artists that are living today that you admire and that influence you. And I'd like to take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
In fact, no, I don't visualize things. However, I have a very close connection with the visual arts. As a young man, when I came back from Paris, and maybe when I was 26 in the late 60s, I had met a young guy there, Richard Serra. We became friends. When I came back to New York, I had a day job at that time. I had a day job until I was 41, as Chris mentioned earlier. And Richard needed an assistant to get ready for a show at the Leo Castelli Gallery. This was in 1969, 1970. I became his studio assistant, and I worked with Richard for 3 years. And when I say I worked with him, I mean it was a 40-hour week. I got up in the morning and went to a studio, woke him up, and we had breakfast together, and we worked all day. I then wrote music at night. My first concerts in Europe, in fact, Richard wanted to go back to Europe in 71 or 72, and I wasn't interested in going back to Europe. And he said, look, come with me to Europe, and every place that we put up a show, I'll get you a concert. And that was the beginning of my solo concerts. We went to the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. We went to the Kunsthalle in Bern. And we went to a gallery, the Ricke Gallery in Cologne. I had three concerts in Europe where we set up Richard's artwork, and then I did the concerts. And on the basis of that, I took the reviews and the publications of those concerts, and I came back to the States and I sent them out, and I portrayed myself as having had a successful European tour, which was, to a limited extent, it was true. And on the basis of that, I began playing in America, so that my performing career was actually launched through collaboration with art. Now, it happens that on June 6th at the Grand Palais in Paris, I am doing a concert. at the same place that Richard Serra is having a sculpture exhibit. So we have actually remained very close friends over the years. But this will be one of the first times in many years that we've actually put our work together.
Philip, are there any sounds that you're particularly drawn to that are not, strictly speaking, music?
The sounds of the ocean, the sounds of the wind, the sounds of nature, in other words, the natural sounds of the organic world we live in. That's the first thing that comes to mind, and is probably that immediate response is probably the most accurate.
Are those the things that you are they at the base of what you're writing, or are they entirely separate?
No, they're separate. They're part of the organic world, in the way that I am. But it could also be the sound of a child breathing at night and sleeping at night. There are organic sounds that come from human beings too that also I'm interested in. I'm very interested in voices. When I talk to someone on the telephone, I can almost at this point I've learned to tell from their voice how they're feeling, how they're physical. When I'll talk to someone and I'll say, "Oh, well, Tom, you sound very well. You sound like you're doing good." To me, the voice is like a picture of the person, and I've learned to listen to voices. I didn't mean to, but I've become skillful at perceiving things about a person through their voice.
Philip Glass will speak tonight. He will also perform at the Nasher Sculpture Center. Tickets are sold out for that event, but you can learn more about upcoming events at nashersalonseries.org. Philip, what an amazing hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.